It's getting warmer. Hope is in the air, people. This is Soft Revolution, the podcast. My name is Torquil Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
And today on the pod, we have an incredible guest for you. I'm very excited to talk to this fellow. His name is Wabkishik Rice. He's a novelist, a journalist, an Anishinaabe writer. And he wrote a book that I recently just devoured, Ali, in like 24 hours. I read this thing. It's called Moon of the Crusted Snow. And it is a brilliantly entertaining and exciting novel, but it's also incredibly prescient. It's almost like he wrote it in 2018. It's his last novel, but it speaks of a disaster, of an apocalypse, of something that he never quite explains that happens in the world, which changes everything and particularly changes a northern indigenous community in northern Ontario. And the book is about how they respond to this change. And man, there is so much in it that I want to talk with Wabkishik about, and there's so much to be gained from reading it. So we're very excited he's coming in to join us today and talk to us about this book and about all kinds of other things. That's coming up. But first, Ali Moman, you are in the very worst place to be right now.
Doug Ford's
Ontario.
Well, there's, worse,
Ontario.
Places. Yeah,
well,
yeah,
there's
yeah.
worse places. But in Canada, yeah. You're in a hot spot, man. How's it going? How are you? How's it looking there? And what are you thinking about these days?
Here's what I'm thinking. So I have a PlayStation 5. And my pursuit of getting this PlayStation 5 involved me following random Twitter accounts, bots, being on a Discord server to figure out when a drop would go to the game spot that I could go on. And it is eerily similar to what getting a vaccine is like right now in Toronto.
But you're choosing to put your energy into the PS5. You don't really care about the vaccine anymore.
No, I got the
PS5.
You
need this PS5.
What I'm saying is, no, I don't need the PS5, but I need the vaccine. So it's crazy. It is like literally just hilarious that the experience of getting a vaccine, booking a vaccine, is the equivalent of getting a PlayStation 5. It is unbelievable. And listen, it is what it is. I want to recommend everybody in all of Ontario, if you're listening, there is a Twitter account called Vax Hunters. And literally, it's just these people that are going around, and when they find out that like a vaccine clinic in Toronto or anywhere in Ontario has open availability, they like tweet it out. So follow Vax Hunters. We're going to put it on the show notes and like turn on your notifications. I mean, you're going to find out where vaccines in Halton and Quebec or whatever. It doesn't make a difference. But this is bonkers. And again, it's just one of those things that like, you know, I'm a techie kind of guy. And if again, in March 2020, I would have created kind of what's called like a shared API that the entire public health, all the units can like hop onto and could be a centralized place. But basically, it's like I shouldn't be hunting for the vaccine. The vaccine should be hunting me.
It's unbelievable.
It should be coming to me.
It's unbelievable.
So I will say, today, Josh Matlow, who is the city councilor for Toronto St. Paul's, and a man of just the creative ideas, you know, who also was an actor, by the way, and told me one day over
oh, really?
The phone.
He said,
he said, honestly, Ali, all your kind of like creative improv training is really going to come into use when you go into politics, because you're going to have to just think on your feet and like figure out how you're going to get things done. But he suggested an Ontario-wide pre-registration that everybody just registers. Everybody says who they are, where they are, what their conditions are. And then the vaccine can come to them. And beyond that, when you do a pre-registration, now, ironically, I called for something like this yesterday, but look, there's no monopoly on good ideas. But I what that does is it actually tells the government where the demand is. And you get a really great idea of how to logistically put the vaccines out and where they should go. Because right now we just have this thing where, you know, in downtown Toronto, our most populous regions that are hotspots, they run out of vaccines. They get like 2,000 a week. Like, it's just weird what's going on. So, you know, I was talking to you today and we were going back and forth about some kind of stuff. And in the back of my brain, I go to myself this. I go, at the end of the day, the vaccines are going to outrun Doug Ford's incompetence eventually, but it's just next level.
Well,
how are
and
you?
I think I'm, you know, I've been talking for the last several weeks about the fracturing of the narratives, and it just keeps happening. You know, as we sit here speaking, there are people listening to us in the United States who are in a completely different place. Some of them have been double dosed. Some of them are finished their vaccine regime. Normal life is resuming in many places. Here in Canada, we're in one of the worst situations in the world right now. and our vaccines do not seem to be coming quickly. And as you say, in our largest province, there's pretty much, I think you can call it chaos in terms of people's understanding of how they accessed this vaccine. So in the midst of all of this, what you and I were arguing about earlier, and this is something to know, folks, we don't just do this when we're on the podcast. Ali and I, we never stop talking about this stuff. We exchange emails constantly throughout the week. So this morning I sent Ali an article published in today's Globe and Mail. You should know right away that there's something wrong with it if it's published in the Globe and Mail. But anyway, and it's called What You Can't. First of all, it's the headline reads, What Can and Can't Do After Your First COVID-19 Vaccine Dose. So they've left a word out in their headline.
Wow,
doesn't
really
engender a ton of confidence in the text that follows. But nevertheless, I'll forgive them that. But what this article amounts to is, in my opinion, more useless fear-mongering. And the reason I say that is because in the middle of this badly printed, misprinted, paternalistic headline that makes people feel irritated from the moment they look at it, there is this information. One of the people who is interviewed in this, Tanya Watts, a professor of immunology at the University of Toronto, says that maybe after two doses of this vaccine, we can all gather together, small groups can gather together outside and have a barbecue without masks. That's absurd.
How is that different than what Joe Biden said? How is that different than what CDC and Joe Biden said, though?
CDC have said,
yeah,
that people who are vaccinated can gather indoors with no masks. That's how
right.
It's different.
Sure.
The CDC guidance is 100% different from that guidance. And that is an absurd thing to say in the face of a society that has been doing that unvaccinated. It's been legal to be outside and have a barbecue with people in British Columbia the entire time this thing's been going on.
So I think she's saying without distance. And without masking. I think that's what she's saying
is irrelevant because she's an immunologist. She's going to say what she's going to say. She's going to base her opinions on science that she studies. She is either a cautious person or a not cautious person. There's all kinds of things about the context of the way she's talking that I don't know. She knows more about immunology than me, so she's got her opinion. What drives me crazy is that the Globe and Mail would publish this incoherent nonsense in the middle of a drive to get people to take this vaccine up. It is absolutely irresponsible. And I'll tell you why they do it, Ali. They do it for two reasons. They do it to, A, provoke the anti-mask, anti-vaccine, anti-lockdown morons. It's a sop to them. It allows them to go around saying, look at what the Globe and Mail and the mainstream media and epidemiologists are saying. This is ridiculous. Are you going to listen to these clowns? And it also provides a sop to the people who never want this to end, who are completely paranoid and living in a totally unrealistic state of fear. It doesn't do a single goddamn thing to help the rest of us who are trying to negotiate our way through an incredibly complicated situation, who want to see people we love, who are looking at information that says that these vaccines are incredibly effective even after one dose, less so in regards to some variants and less so in regards to age. But the vaccine escape is minimal to none around these things in regards to hospitalization and death. And it completely and utterly discourages the impulse that anyone might have to make sure they get vaccinated quickly so that their life can change. It has got to stop, Ali. The media have got to stop trying to make money out of frightening us about things that don't require us to be frightened. I can't say it any better than this. Yasha Monk, who is, I think, a smart guy, a medical writer, a science writer, writes for The Atlantic. He tweeted today, over a year into this, it should be absolutely clear to anyone other than self-interested gatekeepers that no professional guild has the moral authority or scientific knowledge to be the sole arbiters of how societies should respond to a once-in-a-century pandemic. Yes, there is science to be considered. Yes, scientists must be listened to. But you know what? There are other factors involved here. There are epistemological factors. There are educational factors. There's societal factors. There's emotional and psychological factors that need to be taken into account. There's economic factors that need to be taken into account. And so this constant drumbeat of fear-mongering and overcaution and COVID absolutism is doing absolutely nothing except making people scared to get this vaccine and to move on with their lives. And I'll say one more thing before I let you disagree with me, because I know you will. We had a moral responsibility for the last year to do what the scientists were telling us would stop this vaccine, would stop this disease, and allow our medical system, our underfunded, undersupported medical system, to not collapse. That was our moral responsibility. It was my moral responsibility to not see my mom for a while, to not go into bars, to wear masks, to socially distance. And if you don't think that once you are vaccinated, it is your moral responsibility to overcome your irrational fear and return to normal life, then tell that to the working classes. Tell that to the single moms with three kids who need their kids back in school. Tell that to the people who've been working on the front lines this entire time and have not seen their relatives and are now being told that even after vaccination, they have to continue to risk their lives on the front lines and can't see their relatives. It is so classist. It reeks of so much privilege to say to people that this means nothing. And that until scientists, with their incredibly stringent standards of what risk means, are absolutely 100% certain that our risk from COVID-19 is zero, we can't change our lives back again, that's morally irresponsible. That is your responsibility now. Once you get these vaccines, after one vaccine, be cautious. You can probably be around other people who've been vaccinated once safely, but be cautious. Wear a mask outside. Respect people's space. After two vaccines, return to life. And if you don't return to life, you are abdicating your moral responsibility as a citizen. This is not normal. This is not the new normal. This is not how we're going to live. This is not how people function. It's not how society functions. It's not okay. And if you don't know that it's your moral responsibility after you have been fully vaccinated to return to life and take on that risk, then you need to think harder, man. That's my rant. Ali, what are your thoughts on this?
I kind of think, you know, you're a little too worried.
Welcome to my world, Ali. I know I'm a little too worried. Yeah, that's what it's going to say on my gravestone. He was a little too worried.
Okay, first of all, the anti-mask crowd doesn't read the Globe and Mail, so don't worry about it. It's behind a paywall anyways.
No, wait a minute. Read the comments.
No, hold on.
They do read the Globe and Mail. Okay. They love getting ginned up.
Here's what I'll say. What you wrote to me was like, you know, listen, we cannot be telling people that if you, after your first dose, even 2 weeks after your first dose, get lit. The reason why we can't do that is because these variants, according to all data, that you need two doses. And beyond that, one of the issues that we have with two-dose vaccines is that people don't take their second dose. So if the messaging is that after the first dose, it's all good, we have a problem. So we have to make people aware that this isn't a one and done situation. People want to have that, which goes against your point of people not wanting to go back. People are going to want to go back, Torque. People are going to do it, right? So if they're going to do it, let's make sure they got two doses inside them,
when public health officials...
This is not public health official, Torque. This is some immunologist in the Globe and Mail. This is not, Health Canada.
When an immunologist Globe... Wait. But if Health Canada or anybody...
It's not Health Canada, is my point. It's an opinion.
Okay,
it's an opinion of somebody.
Let me address a couple of things you said, okay? Because I've done some research.
You went on. So have I. Let me finish my points.
Okay.
Second of all, 80% of Canadians in a recent poll have said they are going to get the vaccine. Torque, enough of this. Like, people are not taking the vaccine. Literally, people are dying to find this thing. Eventually, we're going to get to a point of demand. Eventually, but we are not there yet. And at that time, what's going to happen is that we're going to see what? Occam's razor. These vaccines are going to work. We're going to see cases go down. As cases go down, public health units and the Ministry of Health, they're going to start opening things up. Life is going to go back to normal. You cannot expect everybody in this population to be like you and I, caring about all this stuff, into the nitty-gritty. Not everyone is like that. People are going to basically listen to whatever even Doug Ford, of all people, tell them they could do. Doug Ford opened up the patios for 2 weeks. What happened? People went to the patios. So as long as people get their vaccines, as long as cases go down, it doesn't matter. Occam's razor shows up. Stuff is going to open up. It's okay. But I think it is worse. It is worse to tell people that after their one dose, they are fine because they will not take their second dose. And you mentioned Yasha Monk. We spoke about him earlier on. What did he say? Humans are going to human. We know this. We all know this, which is why it irritates me when I hear as like a young person under 40 that we are somehow fully responsible for everything going on, because I know, quite frankly, a lot of people who are 50, 60, 70, 80 years old who also have their private gatherings and do what they got to do, because humans, human. Everybody. And that will never stop. So the most important thing is to make sure that people get their two-dose vaccine. That is 100% the thing. And please, Torque, I want you to not worry. People are going to get vaccinated. I promise you this. It will happen 100%.
Okay.
These are two-dose vaccines. Torque, your information is, you have cognitive bias. You are looking for confirmation. You are looking for confirmation. You know, if you really felt that, you know, if it really was the case that like one dose was enough, that is not a kind of messaging that I want to be putting out there. That is absolutely not the kind of messaging that I want putting out
there.
I'm not
saying people to be, one dose is enough.
I'm not saying one dose is enough.
After two doses, four people can gather together. That is a ridiculous thing to say. And it makes people feel like giving up. And it's not helpful.
It has to stop. It doesn't make people feel that way. It makes you, because I think you're worried. It doesn't. I know people who have gotten their first dose. There's a little bit of relaxation that they're feeling, and they're feeling a little bit more protected. But I got to tell you, you know, when you've had nothing, 10, 20, 30 is a lot. 40 is a lot. It feels like freedom. In the same way that the patios were open for 2 weeks, and I went to patio twice. It felt amazing. It was like, you have to realize, Torque, that like it isn't a binary thinking. People aren't on or off with this kind of stuff. I think you need to give the majority of people a lot more credit. I know every Saturday you might see some anti-maskers, and I know you might don't go on social media, but the majority of people, you know, the silent majority, is going to get their first dose, feel a little bit more protected. They'll get their second dose and they'll feel a lot more protected. But at the end of the day, they're going to see case counts, and so is the public. So is the government. And based on those case counts, things are going to open up and they're going to be told what to do. And what they do, as we've learned, they do plus 10. Patios are open yet. Yeah, patios will be open and then we'll do a little bit more. That's how people operate. So when you should worry is if cases go down, vaccines are up, and still they're like, we're shutting down. Then we have a problem. Soft Revolution is brought to you by Effin' Birds, a book and webcomic by our dear friend Aaron Reynolds. But as you know, it's not just a book. It's not just a webcomic, it is also playing cards. And so every single week, I go into these cards, and I pick something out and I read it for you. So today, here's what we got. Okay, it's the Six of Clubs, it's a goose, and the goose is saying, oh honey, no. You know, these cards are so apt with like what is going down in the world right now. So please, go to effinbirds.com, get the book, get the webcomic, get the playing cards, and follow them on social media. Thanks again to Effin' Birds for sponsoring Soft Revolution.
But I 100% agree with everything you just said. However, if these things don't work after one dose, why is our deaths in long-term care in Canada down by 88%? They do work. These things work. And I don't think we're talking at cross purposes here. I'm not disagreeing with you about anything you said. I'm not asking the scientists to change reality and say after one dose, you're good to go. I am asking the mainstream media to stop. It's got to stop. They are so goddamn irresponsible. And it is so unfair to people who've been through so much. Their obligation is to give us the news. Not every time there's vaccine escape and somebody in an old age home gets coronavirus after getting a vaccination, slap it on the headlines and terrify everyone. Nobody said these things were 100%. Nobody expects them to be 100%. It's not a big deal if somebody gets coronavirus after they're vaccinated. It's not news. That's not news. Stop printing it like it's news. Stop frightening people for profit. It makes me sick. All right, let's move on quickly.
The final thing I'll say is that if you give the person a perception that they get their first dose and they're okay. Yes, they will probably be safe from serious illness and death, which is what you're referring to in respect to the long-term care. But, you know, we have a swath, a vast swath of society that is not vaccinated. And so if the efficacy is lower after the first dose, particularly for these Eek variants, the P1, particularly the P1, which is now ravaging British Columbia where you are and coming to Ontario, then you're in a situation where it's like you just want people to be like, look, this is a two-dose vaccine. And after your second dose, I'm going to tell you that it's going to be a lot better. And again, the data will drive us. You know, we have been wanting the modeling and the data to drive the response in Ontario. It hasn't, but the data will also drive what happens. If cases go down due to a lockdown and vaccination, things will open up. People will live their lives because at the end of the day, just like Alan Dutsky said a few weeks ago, he's not worried about this. And I'm with Alan Dutsky because humans have a 2-minute memory. We forget. We forget very quickly. Yeah. I know you think we won't. But I promise you, we will forget.
No, I do think that. Nothing you're saying is not true and doesn't make a ton of sense. I guess maybe I'm not being clear. I am suggesting that this monofocus by the mainstream media on getting whatever epidemic to say the most alarming possible thing they can get them to say, and then printing it on the front page like it's the totality of the conversation, is deeply irresponsible and deeply unhelpful, and it should stop. So there you go. That's me and Ali are fired up today, boy. We are sick of this shit. Everybody's going crazy. The weather's getting warmer. Let's talk a little bit about, before we get to Wahb Kishig, let's get to how this is all affecting art, because we are seeing announcements of things opening up. Stars, my band, just booked a couple of socially distanced shows this summer. Great. I can safely say I'll be seeing you in Toronto this summer, Ali, at a Stars show.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
I can't wait. But I do think that there is this feeling, certainly within myself, that it's like, Jesus, things are so bad right now. It's hard to plan or imagine anything. And as for arts organizations, this situation is incredibly precarious. I wondered what your thoughts were about if you were, say, in charge of a small theater festival this summer, would you be planning a season at all, or would you just like bail? What would be, you know, what would you do in that situation
I would 100% plan it for June, July, 100%. Yeah, 100 people outside, 150 people outside. Yeah, I wouldn't worry about that. Again, you know,
why if it's a double dose vaccine, are we okay to have 150 people outside?
Because once cases go down because of this lockdown that we're doing for 28 days here, and then once, you know, vaccine, the goal is to get people, you know, one dose after the 40%, to get them to 40%. I think at that point, what's going to happen is that case counts are going to be lower. Now, when you're doing this thing, you're still going to be socially distanced and masked. You're still going to be socially distanced and masked. So I think, I wouldn't be surprised to have like 100, 150, 100 outdoors. Sure, I would plan for 100 outdoors, definitely.
I hope you're right, my friend.
I think we're going to do that. Again, these vaccines are amazing, but I think the whole point is like, listen, we're going to have 100 people outdoors. You're going to have a little barbecue. It's all good. You know, we need to start thinking about the other big thing. Eventually, what happens? Like, how do we get, we talk about it. How do we get to the real concerts? How do we get to bars filled up again? How do I like sweat up against somebody?
I've given up on that.
But the other stuff, we're going to get, Torque. I promise you, it's going to be amazing. And you and I will have a nice dinner on a patio, and we're going to have a bottle of wine, and we could just shit on each other live. We might record it. We'll see what happens.
Shit on each other live. Can't wait. But let's move away, Ali, from our endless discussion of whether I should be more worried about the future or less worried about the future. More.
Less we can. More, more. Less we can.
I mean, people do tune in to hear me lose my shit, so I feel some obligation to do so. But thank God you exist in my life, brother. Otherwise, I really would just go off the deep end. I think the way we can sum up the conversation we just had is, you know, yes, everything you're saying is true. After you get one dose of your vaccine, be careful. Also be happy and know that you're more protected than you were before and that you're moving towards full protection. And don't read stupid articles in the Globe and Mail that are there for no other purpose than to gin people up, frighten people, make them feel like this is a morality play, and ultimately sell ad space for the Globe and Mail. I just can't stress enough how sick it makes me when I see mainstream media doing that shit. Stop it. Let's move on. Wabkishik Rice, we have on the show today, and I'm excited, Ali, because I have been eating this book up, Moon of the Crusted Snow, which came out in 2018, but as you will find out in our talk with Wab, it actually sort of got a second life in the middle of this pandemic because it does seem so prescient and it talks about so many issues that are occupying the world right now. Wabkishik is a novelist, obviously, but also a journalist. He worked for the CBC for a long time, and a great, great writer, a gripping writer, who has written a very kind of approachable mainstream book about a lot of things that are very deep and very complicated. And so I highly recommend it. And he also is the co-host, along with Jennifer David, of a great new podcast called Story Keepers. And Story Keepers is a monthly podcast that seeks to talk about indigenous fiction. And they are going to go through over the next 5 or 6 months about 10 or 11 books, all by indigenous writers, and talk about them. It's a book club, which I have put it upon myself to join. And their first book that they're reading is Why Indigenous Literatures Matter by Daniel Heath Justice. They're both incredibly engaging and lively hosts, and their conversation is extremely informative and extremely engaging. So I highly recommend both the podcast and the book. And let's talk to Wabkishik about now and about the past and about the future and about how his people have endured, not through just this apocalypse, not just through this plague, but through many of them. This is Wabkishik Rice on Soft Revolution. Listen, thank you so much for doing this, man. I know that you probably get everybody in the world has a podcast now. And so you probably get tons of these requests. And you have this extremely exciting and engaging new podcast yourself that you're doing that sort of led me to asking you onto the show. And it's called Story Keepers. And let's talk about indigenous novels, about indigenous literature. I've listened to the first couple episodes. I love it so far. Thank you for doing it. I think it's cool. Such an important resource to have, you know, because there hasn't been a kind of open, wide discussion about the notion of an indigenous canon. Does that mean anything to you in terms of the novel? Is part of what you're trying to do with this new podcast create an indigenous canon?
That's a really cool question. And thanks a lot for checking it out, Torkoal. I really appreciate that. And thank you both, Ali, as well, for inviting me on to chat with you. Yeah, this is very exciting. I'm very honored and enthusiastic about this opportunity. I think what we really wanted to do was contain a conversation amongst ourselves as Indigenous readers and writers, but also open it up to everyone else who may not necessarily be familiar with the books that really encouraged and empowered us when we were younger. Because, you know, I think there probably already is a canon or a so-called canon of Indigenous literature, just not everybody knows about it.
You talk in the first episode about your aunt saying to you, you were saying to her as a kid, oh, I love reading, I love literature. And she asked you what books you were reading, and you sort of, you know, listed out the old white guy, books that everybody is made to read in high school. And she said to you, oh, interesting. You know, have you read these books by Indigenous writers? And it was the first time that you had heard of Richard Wagamese or some of these people. And so I think it's really telling that you feel there is an Indigenous canon, but nobody knows about it, right? It's like it's something that has not been established.
No, not in the mainstream at all. And fortunately, I think we are seeing more of these important works get the recognition that they deserve. But back then, you know, I was a high school student in Ontario, and, you know, you'd think that you'd be exposed to the wide array of voices out there contributing to literature. But again, as you mentioned, it was just old dead white dudes, right? So I was fortunate to have my aunt take it upon herself to expose me to this world that really changed my life, you know? So, as I mentioned earlier, there's like a contained discussion of those of us sort of in the know who have grown up with these things, but they were never taught in schools until really just recently, like within the last 5-10 years. And that's really only been a result of, you know, initiatives like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission issuing its calls to action and trying to promote, you know, Indigenous voices in all realms and all that, right? So fortunately, the education system has finally taken note and, you know, is creating courses based on Indigenous literature and incorporating books by Indigenous authors into other English courses and so on. But it didn't really exist up until very recently. And of course, there's still a long way to go, but, you know, we are just part of the discussion. You know, we don't see ourselves at all as, you know, blowing people's minds and opening their eyes to this world that they may not be familiar with. You know, we're just a part of that, I guess, organic community of storytellers that thrive within Indigenous communities and that do great work to bridge the gaps between other communities too. So there's some exciting things happening, and we're just honored and very thrilled to be able to be a part of those discussions.
One of the first things you talk about on the first episode of the pod is the notion that, you know, these books are written in the language of the colonizer, that so many First Nations are storytelling cultures and have this long tradition of oral storytelling, but that the novel is in the context of being written in the language of the colonizer, namely English. Can you talk a little bit about that tension and how you as a novelist kind of resolve that tension between using a vehicle that is one of the colonizer to tell the stories of your people?
Oh yeah, that tension is there, and I don't think it'll ever be resolved for me personally until I become a fluent speaker in Anishinaabemowin, you know, my native language, until I feel comfortable enough to share stories to the same degree that I do in English. So I see it as a paradox very much. You know, we have been assimilated, we've been brainwashed, we've had these languages taken from us, beaten from us ultimately, and many of us are on a long and difficult journey to reconnect with them. So I guess in the meantime, what we do is try to convey our truths and our realities and our experiences to, I think, mostly inspire each other to share each other's stories, but to hopefully ultimately educate other Canadians about these experiences. So yeah, it is like, it's a contradiction no matter what. You know, you're writing about an Indigenous experience with a colonizer's language. And, you know, I don't think I will ever get over that. But at the same time, I'm doing my best within the confines of these languages on my own to express myself, really. And I think that's, you can adapt that across all art forms. You know, you sort of use what's available to you to make a point, to impress a moral upon people, or to hopefully create something that's resonant, you know? So, as long as I write in English, which is what I primarily communicate in, I will have that sort of lingering notion in the back of my head that says, you know, great, you know, you're working hard, but you should be working harder with your original language, you know, the language that you should be equally fluent in as English. So, you know, like I try not to let it weigh on me on a daily basis, but it's always there.
How do you want, now that there is a flourishing and a flowering of, finally, of Indigenous art and culture, in a way that it makes me sad that there wasn't, because it's, you know, it really is the richest aspects of our country, to be quite honest. How do you want, or how do you envision, or is there kind of like a guide you can give to the settler, the non-Indigenous person, to be able to absorb and appreciate this art and to do it in a way that is probably the best? And the reason I asked this, I had an interesting conversation with a Black friend of mine from America who's a prominent artist. And they said, you know, obviously one of the issues that we had is like this notion of appropriation. I mean, there's so many people that you know would kind of take and take and take and take. So what do you think? Like, is there like a guide or a process that you can give to the non-Indigenous person to really cherish the art and not do what usually happens? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. I totally follow you. And that's a good sort of way to think when approaching something that you're not familiar with. And I can't tell everybody what the general template is or what the general guide is, because I don't know everybody individually. Like, you know, if, you know, Jack McGee from Burlington says, hey, I want to know more about Indians. What should I do? You know, it's like, well, Jack, I don't know what your own awareness or knowledge is, and I don't know what your life story is. I don't know what you learned or didn't learn in school. So, you know, it's really hard for me to try to, you know, impart some general wisdom on you that would get you on your way. So I think what needs to happen in the first place is people of settler descent should really do some initial work to place themselves on the land and within the context of this country that has been created around us, which is really in its infancy. Canada is super young, and really ultimately in the grand scheme of human civilization is minuscule. It's tiny. It's fragile. It's weak ultimately, right? So I think people need to take a wider perspective of their existence and really just understand how, you know, they can exist as good people, good stewards of the land, good neighbors, and so on. And then from there, I think that they can sort of tailor that learning to their own understanding and their own experience. And of course, art is one of the best ways to get into it. You know, whether it's music, whether it's film, whether it's books or the visual arts. So yeah, like I guess to respond generally, it would just be understanding where you are and who the traditional inhabitants of that particular territory are, and then seek them out and try to learn their stories and try to learn about them through their art and so on. You know, just to touch on something quickly that you mentioned, you know, people are becoming more aware of art by Indigenous people, but it's not really a renaissance by any means. You know, it's always been there. It's always been created. It's just now that more people are becoming aware of it. So like, to, you know, this discussion has come up a lot as it relates to Indigenous literature specifically. People have asked, you know, within the last 5 years, you know, what do you attribute this renaissance to? But as I mentioned earlier, it's not a renaissance because
it's always been there. Yeah,
it's always been there, you know, so it's just a matter of people paying attention to it. Finally,
how have you maintained hope? You're such a hopeful guy, and I love hopeful people. You know, it's like I'm just drawn to the hope.
I don't know why you hang out with me, Ali. If you like hopeful people, I don't know why we do a podcast together.
You're the chaser, my friend. You're the chaser. I love it. No, you're a deeply hopeful person. I always say, you know, someone like Torque you envision the world to be better, which is a source, which is a place of hope. That comes from a place of hope. But like, how do you, Wob? How are you such a hopeful person?
Well, I would say, I definitely find Torkel's art very hopeful and very influential too. You know, been a fan of his music for a while now. And
thank you, man. That means like, a lot to me.
Oh, you know, I've seen you live a couple times. Always a fun show, you know? So,
thanks,
but just
dude.
To discuss my own journey, like I just look at the course of my life and what's changed, you know? I'm 41 years old, about to turn 42. And I have seen massive advancements, particularly in terms of cultural awareness and historical awareness. And, you know, of course, there's always going to be a long way to go. This is very much not a viable place really for Indigenous cultures to thrive again, because the resources aren't there for that to happen. You know, there still needs to be more supports in place for Indigenous communities and nations to get back what has been taken from them, right? But, you know, when I consider my own upbringing in the 1980s and the 1990s, you know, like Canada has made significant strides in just knowing what that history really is. Because like, there's a myth around Canada of it being this kind, progressive, safe place and not like the United States. And that's the lie that Canadians have told themselves over and over again for decades, right? But those of us from the so-called margins know what the truth is. So Canadians are finally awakening to that truth, and it's a hard acceptance for a lot of them. There's a lot of pushback, a lot of denial. And that's even where you see like the denial around, you know, the impacts of residential schools happening. You know, people just refuse to accept that reality about this country. But, you know, that it's true. It's, you know, racism thrives here because, you know, in many ways, that's what Canada was founded upon, right? So, you know, like having that knowledge in my upbringing was hard, knowing that, you know, that this country that I am looking at from the outside is not the same as, you know, like I perceive it much differently than everybody else who engages with it. But people are understanding those things now. So like, you know, my kids, you know, my two sons will grow up in a world that's even more aware, even more tolerant and even more progressive as it relates to Indigenous issues and culture and so on. So yeah, that's where my hope comes from for sure.
Now until May 15th. This week at Crow's Theater, check out Here We Are by Aaron Shields. Here We Are is many things, a book, a play, an audio recording, and it can all be experienced for free at crowstheater.com. Governor General award-winning playwright Aaron Shields created Here We Are, an unstoppable outpouring of words, thoughts, and emotions to help make sense of the upheaval of the world she experienced over the past year. Featuring music by Thomas Ryder Payne and book design by Alfred Mulroy. Don't miss it.
Listen, let's talk about your book because it's been kind of obsessing me over the last couple of weeks, and I'm so excited to talk to you about it. I ate it up, Wob. Like I read this thing, cool. I couldn't put it down. It reads like a thriller, and I'm sure that was your intention. It's incredibly, incredibly gripping. And the first thing that hits you when you begin Moon of the Crusted Snow is, does Wob have a crystal ball, right? Because it's written in 2018, and it's a book about a sort of unspecified but total breakdown of society. Something happens. The electricity goes out, the power grid goes down, the infrastructure starts to crumble. And in this northern community of Anishinaabe people, they are ready. They have a world that they can create in this situation. And before they know it, visitors start arriving from the south. White people start arriving from the south, essentially asking this community to take them in and solve their existential problem of the fact that their society no longer works. So I'm reading this book and I'm like, wow, it's kind of like science. How did he know this would happen? Like, how did he know? But of course, there's been many apocalypses in your nation, in the world of Indigenous people. This is not the first apocalypse. This is not even the first plague. Can you talk a bit about the idea that you express in the book of displacement? That even as an Anishinaabe community in the north, you have already gone through the experience of being displaced from land, an apocalypse coming, and having to rebuild and readjust. I think that's a really unknown part of the story of the Anishinaabe people and a really fascinating aspect of the book. So can you talk a little bit about that for us?
Yeah, and thanks a lot for reading it and reading
into
that.
Oh man, it's so great. It's such a great book. So good.
Miigwech. Really appreciate that. Well, I'm glad you picked up on that because that was a really important point for me to make or theme that I wanted to explore, was that survival of multiple apocalypses or that rebuilding or recreating society in the wake of it being destroyed. And that was very much influenced by, you know, the elders in my community and the wisdom and insights they imparted upon me when I was a kid, especially my grandmother, you know. So she died a few years ago, but she, you know, was very influential in my life. And this is my dad's mom. He grew up, his father died when he was quite young. So his mother was very influential on all of us. I spent a lot of time with her on the res when I was a kid. And, you know, we talked about anything and everything related to Anishinaabe history and culture. And she was always really proud of it, mostly because, you know, she had seen what people had overcome, you know, even in our community specifically, you know, just how those successive waves of colonialist brutalities, you know, were survived, were outlived and outlasted and so on. It was one thing in particular she mentioned to me, though, that really changed my whole perspective on the apocalypse as it's expressed in art, right? In film and in literature specifically. So her grandparents, you know, people of that generation who were around in the late 19th century, they were the ones in our community, and I speak only of our specific community of Wasauksong First Nation, Georgian Bay, Anishinaabeg. They were the ones who were originally displaced from the mainland, right? And our community of Wasauksong, it's an island community on Georgian Bay. Only about 400 people live on the island. But, you know, although that was a place that Anishinaabeg visited since time immemorial, it wasn't a place that they stayed for, you know, extended periods of time, right? So to understand, you know, the impact of that displacement, you have to go back a little bit to understanding treaty history. So the treaty that our people engaged with was the Robinson-Huron Treaty that was signed in 1850. And there's current litigation around treaty annuities right now. And you know, our people are in court fighting for updated treaty annuities. And I recommend anybody to read up on that particular case because it's happening at the moment and could set a precedent right across Canada in terms of how old treaties are reinterpreted and so on. But that's a whole other thing. I won't go too far down that that rabbit hole. But anyway, so the Robinson-Huron Treaty is signed in 1850, you know, with my ancestors. And then Canada becomes confederated in 1867, as we all know. And so once Canada took rule of these treaties and of these treaty relationships, the authorities at the time interpreted them in different ways, right? So what that meant, even though the Robinson-Huron Treaty is somewhat vague in terms of where it places people, how it was interpreted then was, you know, the people who lived in what's now the Parry Sound, Ontario area, you know, at the mouth of the Sequin River, had to leave that area and go out to this island, which was called Parry Island, but known by us as Wasauksong. So that happened, you know, in the latter half of the 19th century, you know, when my grandmother's grandparents in that generation were alive and well. So she told me one time she heard the story from her grandparents about how they had to move from the mainland out to the island. And then logging became the primary industry in the Parry Sound area back then. So they would sit on the shore and look back out to the mainland and see all the trees get cut down. You know, just the land totally razed. And then, you know, all these structures come up in this town established in the place where they had lived since time immemorial, right? So after that displacement occurred, then, you know, the Indian Act forbade them from actually leaving the community. And then all the other aspects of the Indian Act, which sort of forbade culture and gathering and so on, really, you know, had detrimental, devastating effects, right? So, you know, after that, then, you know, kids started getting taken away to residential schools and, you know, then alcohol was introduced into the community and there's just all this destruction that occurred for decades, right? And she said that that was the end of our world as Anishinaabeg. Our world ended. And what we have now is us trying to pick up the pieces and put everything back together. So that was my understanding of apocalypse from a pretty young age. And I thought, like, people don't know about this at all. You know, Canada exists, you know, on the backs and on the bloody ground of Indigenous nations, you know, and it's imperative, I think, for everybody to understand that. So to have the opportunity to explore that, I guess, in a literary format was really cool. And it's something that I had always wanted to do. And I just really appreciated finally having the opportunity to go deep on that in a literary format. Because, you know, there are all kinds of different fun things I could do with an end of the world kind of story, right? Like, as grim as that sounds, you know?
Yeah. One of the things that I think is sort of spookiest about the book is when in the novel people start to realize that, like, the TV's not coming back on. That the electricity is not coming back on, that their cell phone's not working, and that even in this community of Anishinaabe people who have within that community, they rely to some degree on traditional modes. In other words, smudging ceremonies, and the elders are still very much held in regard, and there's a system around the community, there's leadership and there's organization. There is this sense that that settler culture has impinged even into this remote community, that these people have become reliant on the technology that comes from colonial culture. Hmm. And when it starts to disappear, there's this moment in the book where everyone's like, holy shit, what's going to happen here? You know? And then suddenly, you know, this white guy arrives and he is a potential threat. And then he's sort of absorbed into the community in a very uneasy way, but he is to some degree accepted into the community. There's a lot of talk in the book about the tension between what the main character, Evan, feels is his responsibility as a member of his community and what he feels as a person in a broader sense. When he drinks, you know, when he goes and plays cards with his friends and he has a drink, he feels conflicted and guilty about that. He feels shame about that. When the technology starts to break down, he and his wife have a conversation about how different it is around the house because they're so used to having TV and internet and all these things. Hmm. Is that an ongoing conversation in northern communities a lot? Like, is there a certain group of people within those communities that are like, you know, we should get rid of this shit now because it isn't us. It is not going to save us when the real day comes when we have to go back to the way we used to live.
Hmm. That's a good question. I don't really know for sure the extent of discussions like that, but I do know there is more of a concerted effort to, I guess, instill land-based living into young people, especially, right? And I'm always forthright about this. I am not from a far northern community. Like my res is only a 2-hour drive north of Toronto, right? But placing this story in a far northern community, I thought was essential. And I did a lot of work to do that properly. You know, I had done a lot of research in northern communities and by way of doing stories for CBC when I was a CBC journalist, right? Especially in northern Manitoba and northern Ontario. But, to make sure I did it right, I consulted with a lot of my friends who are from fly-in communities and so on to make sure I had that reality pinned down as best as I could, you know, in a respectful way. And we talked earlier about appropriating a voice or an experience and it happens any and all ways, right? Even like across mm-hmm. Indigenous nations potentially. So, you know, that's why I really worked hard to convey that reality properly. But to answer your question, I can't speak for a far northern community, but I do know just in general that there is a real appetite to, you know, learn how to tan a hide, to learn how to set up fishing weirs in streams and rivers, to learn how to even, you know, use fish skin as, you know, material and clothing and so on. So, but the interesting thing though is you see a lot of this play out on social media, you know, people sharing what they're learning and, mm-hmm. and the teachings and the methods around these kinds of things. So I guess it really is, again, you know, a paradox. It's a double-edged mm-hmm. sword.
So like
in many
the most
ways.
The most modern thing is being used to preserve ancient traditions, right? Like
exactly.
Kind of technology is almost aiding in that. That's fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about the book ends in hope, and I don't want to spoil the ending, but it ends in hope. It ends in a sense that despite everything, this community in some way or another will continue. What are your thoughts about what the last year, what the pandemic has done to all of us, everybody living mm-hmm. in the world, but you as an Indigenous artist in particular, what has it given you and what has it taken away?
Well, for me, I have had a very interesting pandemic experience and in many ways a very fortunate one. My career changed as a result of the pandemic. When everything started to unfold in March of last year, Moon of the Crescent Snow got a bit of a second wind and got a lot more attention. And as a result, you know, my agent, Denise Bukowski, was able to secure me another publishing deal to do the sequel. And when all that came down, it sort of was clear to me that I wouldn't be able to write that story and continue to be employed by CBC just because of everything that I had on my plate, right? So I left CBC mm-hmm. and I ended up applying for a couple of grants at the same time through the Canada Council and the Ontario Arts Council, and, you know, was fortunate to receive those. So I was able to leave journalism and focus full time on being an author. So I had a very, you know, I guess, positive outlook at the beginning. And then our son was born in June. So, you know,
congratulations.
Yeah, that's thanks. Wonderful. Yeah. He has been our light. Absolutely. So it's wild to think that he's going to be a year old pretty soon. But yeah, you know, I was hopeful in the beginning because just in general, as, you know, a regular old citizen of this country, I saw people taking things like food security a little more seriously. You know, people started realizing mm-hmm. that they couldn't necessarily be reliant upon the food that was trucked in to their cities and their towns, that maybe right. they should start considering small-scale agriculture, community gardens, and so on. So I was really inspired to see all that. But as the year plus has dragged on, it's been, you know, disheartening to see a lot of the divisions arise between people. But who knows if that's what the reality is, because my only window into that is through social media, which is by and large, right. as you both know,
we talk potentially a lot about this.
Very damaging. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, yeah. At the end of this all I can do is stay hopeful that people will have learned some lessons from this all. But I'm interested to know what you both think, you know, as hopefully this whole thing winds down.
Well, I have to say that, you know, we're already kind of feeling something that is makes me kind of sad. And we talk about I use this example a lot. You know, Martin Luther King did the I Have a Dream speech, and then somebody came up to him and said, "This is it. This is it. This changes everything." And he said, "No, we have a 10-minute memory." Hmm. And that was then. And now we have the 24-hour news cycle. We have social media. I mean, we're literally swiping left and right for love. Mm-hmm. At least I try to. But but we now have like a 2-second memory.
Yeah.
And we're already seeing, you know, what happened last summer with you know, the death of George Floyd, and yeah. and seeing now what just happened recently with Duante, and it's just like it's just not the same. And so there is this numbing thing that happens to us. So that's why I think it's very important for art to exist, because art has this ability to keep the ball up in ways that regular people can't, you know, because you know, the challenges that we're facing, they will not be solved in our lifetime. And I think as artists, we recognize just the long game. So I do sense that we are kind of descending, and I do worry that while we're happy to get out of this pandemic, you know, eventually with these vaccines, you know, you just don't want people to be, you know, blinded by the euphoria of getting back to life that they forget about, you know, the real depths of life. So, you know, both hopeful, both worried at the same time.
It's a big reason why I liked your book so much, I think, Wub, is that it is a book ultimately about an event, a cataclysm that happens. But within that cataclysm, the lead character kind of learns that cataclysms come and go, that this is part of the cycle of existing, and that there is always a way through it, which is to rely on your community, to rely on your family, to rely on your traditions, and to rely on the land, right? To rely on what's around you. Mm-hmm. And so in many senses, even though there is this cataclysm and there is death in the book and there is violence and sadness, there's also this sense that, like, that if you pay attention to the arc of history, things are survivable and life continues no matter what,
yeah.
that there is an after. And so for me, the book was a very hopeful one in that sense. Reading it right now gave me a sense of the long game that I can often lose sight of in the daily grind of mainstream media and social media and all those things. So I agree with you, Ali. I think that's one of the crucial roles of art, right? Is to remind us that, like, what goes around comes around, and that there really are only a few stories, and we tell ourselves these stories in different forms over and over again, and seem to learn temporarily from them and then get amnesia and forget about them, you know? So,
yeah.
I think the big role of artists moving forward will be to try to not make people, you know, sit in this and just and sort of stew in the sorrow of the last year, but certainly part of it will be, in the same way that Tony Kushner reminded people about what AIDS meant in a broader emotional sense by writing Angels in America, I think that's what we have to do now moving forward, is remind people who they were before this and who they are after it, and why they changed, and why that means something. We don't want to keep you forever, man. I do want to ask you a couple more things. One of them is about,
for sure,
your description of the sacred in the book. There's a description of a town meeting when everybody gets together, and you talk about the burning of sage. And it interested me because it is something that I'm assuming you had, you know, as you say, you went and did a lot of research into Northern communities and how this would have happened in a place you were not from. As an Indigenous writer, there is this, I've spoken to a few Indigenous artists about this, there is this tension that exists where you want to talk about the sacred within your community, but you also want to preserve the respect that it's due. And that as an artist, getting it right becomes a very heavy burden sometimes for Indigenous artists. Can you talk a bit about how you approach that? Is there a difference between you as a novelist when you're writing just like, okay, here's the plot point, you know, this guy comes in with a gun and then this happens, and the Indigenous writer that is trying to honor your ancestors and the traditions that you come from?
Oh yeah, it is a careful balance for sure. And I guess my basic objective is only to write about things that are already out there in the public domain. So you can access video of a smudging ceremony. You can read about it in a news article. You can learn the basics of what a sweat lodge ceremony is online. You can hear and read, you know, trickster stories from various cultures and so on. And these things exist out in the public domain for many different reasons. You know, it can be for representation, it can be for education, it can be for creating connections between Indigenous communities and non-Indigenous communities and so on. But there are things that are absolutely off limits. I believe the stories that are behind the sacred and the ceremonial are off limits and should only be contained within those realms and within those spaces. So, you know, I can write about a sweat lodge happening, but I don't believe I can write the story about how a sweat lodge came to exist. You know, the traditional story we have about how, you know, this ceremony was gifted to us as a people, kind of thing. And to really understand that background often takes days of hearing a traditional teaching, you know, in a very sort of formal and serious way. So I stay away from all of that. Yet I do engage with that knowledge within my community and within my culture as much as I can, you know, and I make sure that I keep it in those places. And part of being a writer for me is making sure that I don't overstep in any way. So I will consult with elders and knowledge keepers, maybe my age and even younger, about certain things that maybe we're not ready to share in that sort of public a way yet, you know? And I have a very fortunate, privileged position of being a former full-time journalist and, you know, a current novelist, that I have a reach and I have platforms, you know, that people, you know, pay attention to for better or worse, right? But yeah, like I make sure that I carry myself in as respectful a way forward as possible, and that anything cultural, almost anything cultural that I share is, you know, referred back to a person to not necessarily get the green light, but just to know that that conversation is out there and to make sure that I'm treating it in a certain way. But there are things that I feel comfortable freely writing about, like growing up on the res, you know, doing a smudge, having those nuanced sort of res discussions, having those, you know, funny interpersonal relationships with various people, seeing how dynamics play out on a community level and so on. Like, that informs most of my writing, really. And I think that's what's the most fun about being in the position that I'm in, is I can convey those realities. And to have somebody come back to me and say, you know, I saw my community in what you wrote. I saw my auntie in this character. You know, I've said this exact thing before, and that will just blow my mind. You know, that for me is the ultimate sort of feedback. And but yeah, that all sort of ties together with the trying to be as respectful as possible. And that's just how I was raised. You know, I just try to honor the people that brought me up.
Awesome. Listen, man, this is a great, great book, Moon of the Crested Snow. I highly recommend it to anybody. But also, you've sort of given me my whole summer of reading, because you're doing this great thing on the Storykeepers website where you've got a schedule. The first book we're looking at is Why Indigenous Literatures Matter by Daniel Heath Justice. And man, I could talk to you about that for another hour. I hope you will come back and join us again so we can dig deeper into these books. But included in this list is books like Return of the Trickster by Eden Robinson and Medicine Walk by Richard Wagamese and Split Tooth by Tanya Tagak, Johnny Appleseed, so many great books ahead, some of which I've read and some of which I haven't, but I'm gonna stick with it. I'm going to go through to November 4th, 2021 cool. and read all these books and be a part of this club. And so if anybody out there is looking for a summer of reading of stuff that is, and a community to talk about those books with in the context of a podcast, it's just such a great, neat idea. And such a great way for people, as you say, within the community to share a discussion, but also for people like me to introduce myself and to get to know more deeply about Indigenous novels. So great idea. Congratulations on both these terrific things. And thank you so much for sharing your time with us today and talking about it. It really means a lot to us.
Well, Chamigwech, thank you very much. And I do want to say quickly that, the Storykeepers was the brainchild of Jennifer David, my co-host.
Jennifer David, the great, yes. And she's so smart. I mean, the first thing she says on the first episode are so brilliant and really kind of opened my mind up. So thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah. And she, David, you know, yeah. I just helped her execute the plan, really. So, but I'm thrilled to do it. It's super fun. You know, podcasting is a new venture for me. And, you know, as you guys know, it's potentially a really cool sort of way to explore different kinds of discussions. So I'm enjoying it.
And to go beyond 280 characters and to explain things with, like, you know, nuance and depth and complexity. And it's really, it's really great. Totally. Thank you so much, man, for being here.
Oh, thank you both. Well, Keisha, had a great time.
Thank you, man. Really appreciate it and hope we can talk soon again.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Wahb Keshik Rice on the Soft Revolution podcast. Thank you so much, Wahb, for joining us. Such a cool book, man. You got to read this book.
Yeah, I'm definitely picking this up.
It's really, really good. And after we got off air, I managed to pry some information out of Wahb Keshik about what the sequel of this book would be. If you haven't read it yet, I'm not going to spoil it for you, but there's a huge bunch of unanswered questions at the end of this book. So I'm really excited to read the sequel, and I hope that we see it soon. Get writing, Wahb. Come on. I need that sequel.
I also loved what he said about, you know, in respect to why he has hope. And, you know, he said, I think he's like going to be 41 or 42 or something. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be 38. And there's something about, like, our ages in that we've actually seen in front of us so much growth and progress. And especially being, for me, like an immigrant kid, I've seen so much growth and progress. And it's something that I try to tell, like, the younger folk, that I say, like, all these things that you know, you've come out of the womb already knowing, like, you have no idea. You have no
idea
how we've come. Yeah, they were learned. And it's really important to recognize that, because if you're not able to celebrate small successes, you will never have hope. You have to celebrate the small successes. Otherwise, hope goes away. And then we get to what we see on social media.
So, totally. You know. And one more cool thing that I will say that I think we should delve into more on this podcast is, you know, I've driven across Canada 5 times now, Allie, in the last year, because I'm a lunatic, but also because
To clarify, you mean from Quebec all the way to BC, correct?
Correct. Yes. And one of the things that you learn very quickly when you do that is we think of Canada far too often as being a collection of cities and towns within a couple of 100 miles of the U.S. border, ignoring the fact that the vast, vast, vast majority of this country is made up of the North, or what we think of as the North. And there is so much richness, there is so much to learn from the North, not just from Indigenous communities in the North, but from the actual natural world of the North and what it means to live in the North. And this book addresses so many of those things beautifully. And I think it's,
you know what's so funny about that? It's like, you know how like the Raptors have that t-shirt that says "We the North"? No. They the North.
Yeah. But it's, but there's a lot in that, and there's a lot of art that can come out of it. And, so I think for me, you know, reading this book is partly just a reminder that I need to get to know the North better. I need to get to know the people of the North better. I need to get to know their traditions better. But I also need to understand what that vast emptiness and what that incredible landscape really means within the context of being a Canadian. And I think it's easy to forget that when you're in downtown Toronto. But this country really is defined by spaces that so many of us have never even seen. And I think it's important that we all, given that we can't travel abroad for the next couple of years, be a good time to get to know the North.
Oh, less than that, Torque. Less than that.
Oh, Allie, it's never happening again.
Jesus. I swear to God, I hope I win the lottery. I'm going to take your ass to Italy. Like, come on.
We're going to Stanley Tucci it all over Italy.
Yeah, you know, we're going to Tucci, you and me.
Listen, did you see that Stanley Tucci show? The whole time, I only watched an episode of it. The whole time I was like, is this motherfucker wandering around Italy in the middle of a pandemic eating Italian food? Like, what is going on here?
But can we also talk about how lucky this man was to shoot it when he shot it?
Unbelievable. Break. Unbelievable.
Or maybe it's all in the studio in LA. We don't even know.
Yeah, maybe it's green screen.
He hates you too. Anyway, no, I'm kidding. I don't know.
please read Wabkishik Rice's book, Moon of the Crusted Snow. Please check out his and Jennifer David's podcast, Story Keepers. It's all good stuff. That's Soft Revolution for another week. Allie, what is your art pick this week?
Well, you know, this is kind of, it's interesting, serendipitous. It's stemming from that whole thing of hope. And, you know, as the world changes, it goes back to some kind of normal. It's up to us to kind of keep the ball up in the air as artists. And there was this book that our dear friend Sarah Sleen read. It was Robert Reich's book, and she shared it on Twitter. And she shared a quote that I think Robert Reich put on, and it's by Reinhold Niebuhr. And the quote is, "Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we must be saved by love. No virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as it is from our standpoint. Therefore, we must be saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness." I found that so powerful. And I read that and I said to myself, yeah, this is up to us as artists. This is our game. This is what we understand. This is how we do. This is how we roll. So thank you, Sarah, for sharing that quote. I love quotes. I have a whole like a note in my iPhone just full of just like quotes like this that I go back to just to kind of keep myself afloat. Yeah.
Love it. We got to get Sarah on the pod soon.
Yes, I think she would love to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, let's do that. Okay, so my art pick this week is another Indigenous artist that has been really blowing my mind lately and actually has for quite a few years. Her name is Leanne Betasamasik Simpson. They are an Indigenous artist, not just a writer, but also a musician. I got to know Leanne through music. I did some of the I did a cabaret in Toronto with them, and but they have a new book out that is really, really amazing. So I guess I'll mention a piece of music that they wrote, and we'll play that at the end. But the book is what I'm focused on right now. It's called Nupaming, The Cure for White Ladies, and it is unlike anything I've ever read before. It starts in the ice. It starts with a figure being frozen in a lake. And from that place, it explores a number of beings, an old woman, an old man, a tree, a caribou, a stone, a geese. And it's a fascinating read, not just in terms of what's in it, but the actual physical act of reading it is fascinating because many of the pages contain only a few words. So a lot of the time you're turning blank pages with one sentence maybe or one paragraph on them. And so those sentences and those paragraphs take on an incredibly strong power. They have this kind of power in isolation that really hits you. The other thing that fascinates me about the book is the use of the pronoun they. You know, as we move forward and gender rights and gender awareness become a part of human society in a way that it should have been for many years, and we use pronouns that people feel more appropriately describe their personhood, one of the ones that I've always found awkward from an etymological point of view, from a language point of view, is the use of they, right? When you're speaking in conversation, it's difficult to remember, and it doesn't quite capture what it means to be two-spirited or to be a person who feels they contain multitudes. But within the context of literature, Leanne uses they throughout this book, and it suddenly kind of dropped the veil for me about what that means. About what that pronoun, about the power of using that pronoun when you talk about an entity, about a human or a living entity, and how appropriate it is in the context of literature, and how it kind of blurs the lines between a human, a rock, an animal, a piece of ice, that we are all in some respects a they, that we contain within us water, all the elements of the earth are contained within us. And we contain within us all the elements of our different selves, our separate histories, our separate stories. So there's lots to be gleaned just from the physical act of reading this book, but it's also got real beauty and real power. And it really does seek, like very few books that I've read before, to kind of rewrite the form and to change the way that you look at what you think of as a novel. It's kind of half poetry, half novel. And that's not surprising because Leanne is also a musician and a great one and puts out great records. So I'm hoping that we're going to go out on one of their pieces of music / poetry. But I'm really, really, my pick this week is this great book that I think everybody should read called Nupaming, The Cure for White Ladies by Leanne Betasemaseke Simpson. So that's my pick for the week.
Boom.
That's After Love Evolution. It. For another week, thank you to Wabtishik Rice for joining us this week. Go check out his book, Moon of a Crusted Snow. And listen, if somebody tells you there's a vaccine to be had, go get it. Doesn't matter which
they
one it is.
They are going to get it. Everyone's
get
getting
your ass
it.
Down
Everyone.
There. And
Everyone's
then after
getting
you do, after you do that, do something you haven't done before. Don't, you know, make out with a stranger. Don't lick a lamp pole. But maybe have some people over to your backyard and enjoy a few beers. Relax. Life's going to get better. Don't let the goddamn Globe and Mail frighten you. All right. Love you all.
Yeah,
love
Tork.
You, Allie.
Don't let it frighten you. Love you. Okay.
This entire
Bye.
Podcast is just a conversation
like
with
you.
Myself. I know. It's just me doing self-soothing. Stay safe. Stay sane.
Okay.
Join us again next week for more Soft Revolution. Love you, Allie.
Love you, man. Bye.
Thank you. to the surface. There is euphonic rising and falling, orbits of dispossession and reattachment, achieving maximum density, 39.